are pleased to have with us today Dr. Elder Meyer. He was raised on a farm near Okarchi, Oklahoma, and he was a farmer. He graduated from Oklahoma State University in 1951 and was a farmer in Oklahoma and Kansas from 1951 to 1958. He then attended our Springfield Seminary and graduated in 1964. He first served a triple parish in rural Minnesota, Hollandale, Lansing, and Blooming Prairie, Minnesota, from 1963 to 1966. From 1966 to 1971, he served as a campus pastor in Kearney State, Nebraska. And then from 1971 to 1978, he served as senior pastor of Trinity in Grand Island, Nebraska. And then in 1978, he was elected the president of the Nebraska District and served in that position until 1991. He is now serving as the director of Preserving and Growing Rural Congregations. This is a project of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and he is traveling and speaking. He certainly knows about ministry in rural communities. He has also brought his wife with him today, and we welcome her as she joins us, and we welcome to our campus Dr. Elder Meyer.
Thank you, Dean Smith. It's certainly a pleasure and a privilege to be here and share with you some of the excitement of rural ministry. Share with you, you know, what rural ministry is all about. Maybe just a couple of things that I'm doing. My remarks today or this morning will be based on my observation as a parish pastor in rural Minnesota and rural Nebraska. Also, my observation as a district president, in which Nebraska district is really a rural district. We have 250 congregations, and we would identify approximately around 200 to 210 as rural. I worked with those over 13 years, and many congregations many times, because many congregations would call a graduate. And in 13 years, I've been in some congregations three and four times at a pre-call meeting. And then also my observation as director of the project of Preserving and Growing Rural Congregations. And nothing that I say today is really meant in any way to be offensive, to offend anyone. It's drawn from my perceptions in the years of ministry, which basically have all been in rural areas. I'd like to just say a few things. I'll try to watch the time, because Dean Smith indicated it'd be good to have questions the last 15 or 20 minutes. There's so much material in these areas, but I think it's important that we touch probably four areas. One is rural, you know, what does that mean? The other is, you know, what are the values of the rural areas? Because that's very important when you look at rural congregations, and the values of rural America have really made our church what it is today. And then also the full service, mini service congregations, and briefly just share the 20 characteristics of a full-service congregation, and relating full-service congregations to full-service rural communities. And then the conclusion, some concluding thoughts. Maybe just a couple comments then on the rural scene. You know, prior to the 20th century, America was rural. And we would say that our nation, what it is today, has a great relationship to where our nation was. Up until through the 19th century and up to the 20th century, and even the beginning of the 20th century, you can see that it's very rural, because the frontiers were pushed back, and as long as there's more land available, but once the land was all taken by someone, then people began to buy from each other. And family farms changed down through the times. you know, when America was discovered, you know, 500 years ago, and the Indians taught the first settlers how to plant grain, and there's a lot of stories about that, how to hunt. And from that point on, it has changed, and changed drastically. It hasn't been changing. In the 80s, and the agri-community crisis of the Midwest and the entire nation, there were some drastic changes at that time. And the number of farms declined drastically. The population in rural areas even declined much more. The change doesn't stop, and it hasn't stopped at this time. Where family farms once were very small, 80 acres, 100, 120 acres, today a family farm is from 640 to 1,000 acres. A single person, a farmer by himself, especially if his wife can be a team and drive one of the tractors and get involved in feeding, they can handle 1,000 acres by themselves comfortably. Large farms are in style, and maybe just a little bit, I failed to say, in the project, I have visited nearly 50 congregations in 6 Midwest districts, the 2 Dakotas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Iowa West. And my visitation is a day in the congregation and in the community. And that's been very enlightening, to walk in the community, to talk to various people in the community, to ask various questions, and to sit with the congregation in the evening, visit with the leadership, and to get their perception of what has taken place. And without question, in those meetings, they have said that population in rural areas will continue to decline, and the number of farms will continue to get fewer in number. You know, a person can't hardly imagine what a large farm is today in comparison to even 30 years ago or 20 years ago. It's not uncommon for a farm to have 16,000 acres. 16,000 acres, of course, you know, is quite a spread. That's 100 quarters, 25 sections, or 5 square miles. Visiting in one community, I asked, what's a large farm here? I said, well, varies 5, 6, 7,000 acres. But we have one farmer that has as his goal to have 100 quarters that he is farming. And last count this spring, he had 87, so he had only 13 more quarters to lease or buy. And after that, I have asked several places. Just this past week, I was told that this farmer has 16,000 acres. It varies. It varies on the topography, the highly erodible land, and how much grazing there is. But when it's flat, like in Red River Valley and other places in Nebraska, Oklahoma, Kansas, and the Dakotas, you know, several thousand, 5, 6, 7, 8,000, even 16,000 acres common. But what does that do to the rural church? What does that do to the population? And what does that say there? And today, it's visit with a family, and it's very common. And as 4 generations sitting there, I had made arrangements to visit with the chairman of the congregation when I drive out to the farm. This has been a couple months ago. The wife immediately said, well, yeah, just a minute, I'll call Dad. About that time, the son came in, so we're 3 generations there. It's family operation. Past 4 generations, and they have 5,000 acres in operation, and there's one son, which would be grandson of the grandfather. I asked the grandfather, I said, your grandson going to take over? He said, no. Why not? I wouldn't even encourage it. Here's a grandfather in his 70s saying, there's no money in farming, there's no future in farming. So I asked the wife, what about your son? And she said, well, I wouldn't encourage him to farm. There's just no future in it. And so those are the things that are very much alive in rural America today. Rural communities, the rural community, you know, in times past in the 20s and the 30s, and, you know, a rural community of 2 to 400 population was a full-service community. They would have 2 or 3 medical doctors, 2 or 3 grocery stores, a hardware store, a couple of implement dealers, and a car dealership. And it was possible because each quarter section had 2, 3, or 4, or 5 families. But as a number of people left the farm, those rural communities went to mini-service and no longer full service, what happens? There's nothing to encourage people to move into a mini-service community. But we would relate that also a little later then to the congregation. So the trend in the rural Midwest is quite clear. Many of these villages, which were once full service, today are mini-service, and also become, you know, rather ghost towns, rather sad, the way some of these villages look. The characteristics of a rural community And this without exception, in almost nearly 50 congregations visited, these characteristics came up. And the question I always asked was, why do you live in this rural community? Why are you here? Or why did you move back? First reason they always gave, trust and safe. It's a trusting place, and it's a safe place. And it's why, explain it to me. And this always came up too. Well, we never lock our houses. We leave the keys in a pickup. And so they said, well, how many of your keys are in the pickups and the cars outside? And a lot of times it'd be all but one or two, and a lot of times it would be only the pastor who had locked his vehicle out there. And, you know, what does that say to the people there? Always had a scribe because I used newsprint, and the young lady that scribed, you know, she says, well, she says, you know, I don't even think the locks on our house work. And the husband said, oh, no, you didn't say that. You shouldn't have said that. He got all nervous and excited. And pretty soon he said, well, he says, you know, we talked a little bit more in prison. He said, well, see, you know, 2 years ago, somebody walked in. Of course, it wasn't locked. And she's right, locks don't work. Somebody walked in, stole the television, microwave, and a VCR. Well, I had to make a decision. He said, then I thought, you know, that's the only thing that's been stolen in 20 years. And if that's all that gets stolen in the next 20, it's not worth fixing the locks. But that's the kind of trust they have. And it's very common for the older dads, you know, the people in their 60s who are retired. They say, well, brother, well, just pull the door shut and leave. Not lock it? No. Somebody might need something. They might need to come in and get something. And it's very common for farmers, and can you imagine leaving keys in an $80,000 tractor, $100,000 combine, and to come home, it might not be there. Well, neighbor so-and-so, so-and-so may have borrowed it. And there's a trust. Caring, a neighbor, the rural communities really know what the vocation of neighbor is. Being a neighbor. Like the Good Samaritan, when Jesus said, which one of the three was neighbor to him? Or when Jesus said about the second great commandment, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. Rural communities really put that into action, and they live that. They live those words to a great degree. And that's important. And that's part of the rural culture. Friendly, you know. People in rural America, they drive with a hand on top of the steering wheel and they always wave, you know. Everybody waves like that. And it's kind of strange. Some places they wave with one finger, some places with two. Some places they do like that, you know. But that's important. A couple weeks ago, I was giving a keynote address for a conference in Iowa. And I mentioned some of these things, and pretty soon a young pastor, 5 years in the ministry, came up and talked to me and the one leader, the host of the conference, and he says, you know, that's right. He says, I'm a young pastor, which is obvious, and he said, I've been here 5 years, and about 2 months ago, I had a call, and so I asked the elders to evaluate my call with me. And one of the elders looked me in the eye and says, you're stuck up. Well, he said, you know, I didn't know how to take that. This elder called me stuck up, and I've been there 5 years. He says, you never wave. And this young pastor said, well, back where I come from, which is Detroit, you don't wave at people. This elder looked at him in the eye and says, you're not in Detroit, you're in Iowa. And that's very important characteristic to these people out there. That's part of the culture. That's part of being friendly. And this pastor felt real bad that in 5 years he had not recognized the importance of waving, the importance of friendliness. And you know, this privacy glass on pickups and cars is not user-friendly in rural America. Cohesiveness is a high level of cohesiveness, a bond of fellowship and togetherness, and which is only possible when everybody's doing the same thing. When it's planting time, they all plant. When it's seeding time, you know, or harvest time, they all harvest. And that is a very important commodity. Fellowship, being neighbor, and drinking coffee. Many of these rural communities, the farmers come in and drink coffee. Some places it's one shift, 9:30 in the morning. Some places it's 6:30 and 9:30 also. And there was one community where there was two shifts, 6:30 and 9:30. And you know, in this congregation, they made sure that I understood, and they told me repeatedly, our pastor gets up at 5:30, he drinks coffee with the farmers at 6:30, he goes to the office for 2 hours and makes a second shift and drinks coffee at 9:30. And they wanted me to know that he's an early riser, because you know, rural communities do not like pastors that sleep till 9:30 a.m. They make fun of him. That may not be right, but they do not appreciate that. They like pastors to be up and around when they're up and around. Another important aspect is school districts are very important. A good place to raise a family, that's always left to the top. Rural areas are a good place to raise a family. I did a lot of visiting in the community, walked in a grocery store, talked to this lady. I said, "You live here?" "Yeah." She says, I said, "Why do you live here?" "Good place to raise a family." "Why is it?" She said, "Well," she says, "you know, I commute in a neighboring town, my husband commutes, kids come home from school," she says, "they can run the whole community, everybody knows they're my kids, if one of my kids get hurt, everybody knows where they belong, they'll take care of my son or daughter just as it is their own, and then they'll get a hold of me and tell me what happened." Good place to raise a family. That's a high value. Quite different than metro, isn't it? Where metro areas, you know, and another one they said, that crime and drugs is minimal. It's pretty hard to commit a crime, steal a car, when everybody knows who that car is. It's pretty hard to sell drugs when everybody knows who you are and who you're selling them to. And so there is that kind of deterrent there. Just one thought on the metro. You know, the metro is very compartmentalized. You know, and it's that way. They have the work week is from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. That's a very strong compartment. Then they have the weekend, and many people say, "I live for the weekend, I live for the weekend." And then they have the church life and the family life. And so these various lives can add up to a busy week for the people who live in Metro America, but they are separate entities. In rural areas, it's a cycle. And in rural areas, one of the things that people like, and farmers like, is they can get a fresh start, a clean sheet every year. If the crop wasn't that good, if they had some problems in the spring, they start over again. And when they're planting, everybody's planting. When they're harvesting, everybody's harvesting. And so they talk to each other about these things. And so it is that strong difference. Rural congregations. What is a rural congregation? Rural congregation is a congregation of Christian people who live in an agriculturally oriented lifestyle. Rural is a mindset. Rural is a culture. It is a perceptive toward reality. It is a way of life. It is not poor or rich. Rural is not necessarily educated or uneducated. It is not necessarily better or worse than other lifestyles. Rural is a unique value system, which I tried to share. But the rural orientation of life carries with it characteristics that have an enormous impact on the Christian church and on our church. It helps describe not only what people think, but how they think and how they perceive reality. It helps to describe how they perceive the church to which they belong or what they perceive the church to be. For us, you know, the rural congregation or synod is not in jeopardy at this time, but it could be if we do not accept them, etc. So there's several gifts that rural gives to the church. The first one, of course, is to be neighbor, the vocation of neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. Another gift is the gift of service. Reaching out, volunteerism. The fourth gift is the ability to struggle with hard questions. Rural congregations, rural people struggle with difficult questions. And one of the questions I struggle with now, alternate styles of pastoral leadership. At our size, can we afford an ordained pastor? So rural church is a giftedness to the people of God, to the members, but also then to the entire community. So we need to lift that up. Community involvement of the pastor and the congregation in the rural community is a must. There are many areas of possible involvement of the pastor and congregation. The many areas are, you know, one community has a teen center in which our congregation really sponsors and is the main participant. Senior citizen centers, offering meals at noon for the older people in that community. And also the whole aspect of God, of the environment, the ecology, taking care of God's earth. Rural congregations and communities expect the pastor to be visible in there. After all, when a pastor drinks coffee with the farmers that are his members and non-members every morning or several times a week, there's no better way to learn and see the hopes, the joys, the concerns, the problems, and the blessings of that rural community. A pastor who does that will have many things that he can point, that he can illustrate with his sermons that Sunday morning. Look at the Bible and think of all the illustration of parables and the miracles and the words of Christ that relate to the rural area. Pastors in a rural community have failed in the past not to utilize where they live and the things that happen in God's creation and the whole creation of life and the ecology of it as an opportunity for ministry. This rural church esteem is rather low in many areas. And I guess I would just lift, why is the church esteem low? I guess one of the first contacts with these nearly 50 congregations with the pastors say, well, elder, one of our problems is we have such a low feeling about ourselves. We don't feel good about ourselves. I hope you can analyze that and get that going and lift the small church esteem that is out here. Well, we have all contributed to that, and some of the contributing factors to the low church esteem of rural small congregations is, of course, the denomination itself, the church, national and district, because we have always, not intentionally, but helped them to see that, you know, they really are not important, because everything the synod does and the district does is geared for the populace, for the metro, the suburban, the ethnics, and this type of thing. And so we have led unintentionally the denomination and leaders of both synod and district that they're really not that important. The only ones important where the people are, where you can have fast numbers and quick numbers. Pastors, too, have contributed to it. Up until a few decades ago, a good part of the seminary students were from rural areas. But as that population declined, that no longer happens. And then what happens is we place so many graduates in rural areas, and they don't stay very long. And this upsets the rural congregations tremendously, but also it doesn't help their small church esteem, because they're no value. The only thing they can afford, the only thing the church will provide for them is a graduate. The only thing that, and so then the graduate stays 3 years or 2 years. At another conference, I was a circuit counselor came, he said, you know, oh, that's right, he says. And he mentioned a place and a district, and I won't mention that. He says, a graduate came in and said, well, he said, I don't like it here, and I want you to know that I'm not going to stay very long. And sure enough, he stayed 3 months, and he was gone. Because he didn't fit, and he had no intention of really learning that whole culture and climate. And that really hurts a small church and a rural church. The model of parish also doesn't inflate, deflates, because we're only good enough for a half-time pastor. Gross stagnation, what happens when the community is declining? And the whole thought, big is beautiful and small is ugly. And we could dwell a lot on that, on the whole aspect of size. But there are some things we can do to lift that. The pastor can, and the district leadership can assist the congregation in developing an edifying climate. A climate of congregation that indicates, you know, there is some worth there. There are people there. And the body of Christ is there in that church. Find the strengths of the congregation. Every congregation, small, even if it only has 50 members, has some strengths. And remove the roadblocks. Of course, one of the big roadblocks, everybody says, is gossiping. In the nearly 50 congregations, only in 3 congregations did gossip come up as a problem. And I said, well, that's strange, because everybody says, and particularly young pastors say, gossiping. And analyzing it, I perceive, oh yes, there's a lot of talking going on, but what are they talking? It's informational. So-and-so's planning today. You know, so-and-so's tractor broke down. And the whole aspect of their conversation is informational so that people can know what's going on in that community. And so they really don't look at that a lot as gossiping. And sometimes I perceive that it is only the pastor that perceives that as gossiping, because they are sincere when they talk about one another. Positive motivation, there's always somebody in a parish that's negative, willing to destroy down. But there's always and what does the pastor do? You know, you can't give these kind of people a lot of exposure, but how to do that is another question. But there's always somebody who has positive. When something a door closes, he's always opening another one. He's always thinking positive. And I think along this line, Freeman, South Dakota, had celebrating a centennial. And in the celebration of centennial, they had a speaker come in. And I'll just lift a couple phrases. And what he said was this: say something good about Freeman and watch it grow. And that was the whole thrust of his presentation for Freeman, South Dakota. Say something good of Grace Congregation and watch it grow. Say something good of St. John and watch it grow. And this whole aspect of positive motivation is Christian, is putting the best construction on everything, and it's important. And I think we need to do that. Celebrate victories. There are a lot of victories we can celebrate, from anniversaries and high school students achieving something, parents achieving something, whatever. Celebrate victories. Possibility thinking. In these rural communities, the whole aspect of the full service community, you know, as a service dropped for a long time, but they had two implement dealers. When one implement dealer closed, that wasn't too bad. When they had three grocery stores and two of them closed, still had one, it was still full service. But when they lose a primary service, be that a school district, be that medical, or be that a grocery store, there's a domino effect in the community. A domino effect. And pretty soon there's nothing there. And it becomes a ghost town. And same way with congregations. Full service congregations in the Midwest, and well, all over, that I'm addressing a Midwest rural issue, full service congregations, when these congregations start in rural Nebraska, rural Kansas, or wherever it is, 100, 130, 140 years ago, they were full service. You know, they were the communication center of the community. They were, the education center, the social center, the spiritual center. It was all at full service. They had youth ministry and everything. And the same thing is true with the rural churches, I guess all of them, but rural churches as rural communities. If a rural congregation says, well, you know, we only have four teenagers in all of high school, that's not enough to have a youth ministry. No longer full service. And we recognize that when a full service such as youth ministry is not there, why would anybody join that has teenagers? And we recognize that the one thing that these congregations, that families want when they look for a congregation, is a youth ministry program. But you can do that always. Well, you know, Sunday school in the summertime is really hard to do because families are gone, etc., so we don't have Sunday school in the summertime. Again, no longer full service. And we can take any one of those ministries, and when a congregation drops one service, they are no longer full service of the many services the congregation offers. And they are then on the demise. Pretty soon it's a domino effect. Pretty soon another service is dropped. Pretty soon another service. Pretty soon they join with a dual parish. Pretty soon then they only have worship on Sunday. But a congregation that maintains full services will grow, even in rural America. I give you 20 characteristics and items for a full service congregation which need to be evaluated. In the congregations I'm studying, I ask them to evaluate themselves. I share that with them, then I evaluate them on the basis of these 20 characteristics and entities and items. And then I make recommendations on how they can improve that so they can maintain and be a full service congregation in rural America. First one that's always there is almost, with almost without exception, when in the visitation they say, what's one of your strengths? We want the Word of God to be taught in its truth and purity. They really want that. But the other thing often you find is, but with some flexibility and sensitivity to people. And the phrase came up several times. It wasn't original with me. Faithfully flexible, whatever that means. We'll have to spend some time on that sometime. But a strong commitment to the Word and sacrament is a priority and a must for rural congregations. Next one is worship. Worship is a time for the family of God to be together. That's a very strong Old Testament tradition, important, and we have many psalms that relate to that. And to me, it would be important if the congregation, on a quarterly basis, were to evaluate their worship. Let the members evaluate the worship. Is this communicating to them and to the community? The other thing I think, you know, when you go to motels by the time of a restaurant, evaluate us. Tell us how we did. And so you have the privilege of evaluating a restaurant that you ate at, the motel, etc. What would happen if in the congregation, especially rural, what I'm talking about, is as a guest or visitor walks in, the usher would hand them an evaluation sheet and say, evaluate the worship this morning and hand it back to us to see if we are meeting the needs. Music is important almost without exception. Congregations that are vibrant and growing have a good music program, good choirs, several choirs, be children's choir, adult choir, etc. But it's very fascinating to see that music is a very strong entity for a full-service church and for a vibrant congregation. But the next several, of course, are Bible studies, adult Bible study. This is often very low in rural areas, so low that many would say it's almost non-existent. But that's an important item for a full-service congregation, is to have Bible study, cell groups, Sunday morning, and cell groups in various homes throughout the area. And to use adult Bible study as an outreach arm. Teenagers, I think only about a fourth of the congregations visited had a teenage Bible study. Why? Well, we only have a couple. I perceive that even if there's only three teenagers in the entire congregation, if they were to sit down once a week on Sunday or otherwise with an adult counselor or with a pastor, that would be a faith-growing experience, and these teenagers would really appreciate and grow like crazy spiritually, but it would be a growing experience for the lay counselors also, or for the pastor, if he were to do that. And then, when you look at the rural areas, a lot of times we'll have a congregation right here, but around it, there will be three or four or five small communities varying from 25 to 50 people to 160, 175 people. And as I visit those communities around there, one area particularly I kept a record of, over half of the people I talked to on the streets and the stores of the community, seven communities around our church, didn't belong to church. Over half did not belong to church anyplace. And in many of those, one congregation, a community church, whatever, where they also have no teenage ministry. And teenagers can be a powerful outreach arm to other teenagers in the outlying communities in the rural areas, and offer them an opportunity to relate to Christian teenagers and relate to our Lutheran church in that area. Fantastic opportunity. Sunday school, these congregations are really think they have to have a strong Sunday school, and basically they have, most of them very strong Sunday schools, but they're always concerned about the numbers and consider that a negative, rather than thinking that big isn't always beautiful. Small can even be more beautiful because of the person-centered aspect of a small Sunday school or a small Bible class. Weekday school also, to expand the confirmation class, is very important, and probably only existent in about 30 of the nearly 50 congregations. Vacation Bible school. One congregation, I'll just share what they're doing, and then you can draw your own conclusion. I said, how about vacation Bible school? Oh, we have a good vacation Bible school. We have a good one here, and it really reaches out. We have about 50% that are not our members. And I said, yeah, we have vacation Bibles twice a summer. In June, our church has it, and in August, the Methodist Church has it. They encourage theirs to come to ours, and we encourage ours to go to theirs. These communities really appreciate that kind of cooperation, which many of us would have a question with and would have a problem with. And I asked this pastor, and I said, what are you doing about that? How do you feel about it? He said, I don't feel very good at all. He said, I'm helpless. They've done that for many years, and the entire community appreciates that and requests it. So I haven't touched it in 5 years. And he has a real guilt problem with that, because that's where the community is, and that's what he feels the need to do because the community requests it. Youth ministry, and I think I mentioned that, very few youth ministry programs out there because there's only half a dozen or less teenagers. I think it's important a lay counselor, a pastor and his wife, take the two or three teenagers and spend some time with them every week or every other week at least. Go places with them, do Bible study with them, and that would be a fantastic. Think what that could do to three or four teenagers in that congregation for the future of the church. If every rural congregation did that, would be powerful. Would be powerful. Lay leadership, the thing that I always hear, we got to get more people involved in leadership. But what I always hear is they want to be people involved in the elected leadership. And so many of our rural congregations are overstructured. And elected leadership oftentimes is not a whole lot of ministry. It's just process and take care of this, take care of that. And what we really need is greater leadership involvement in all of the areas of ministry. Leadership in evangelism. Leadership in Bible study, leadership in older adult ministries, involving older adult ministries, leadership in volunteerism. Leadership that's important in rural areas is leadership and one-on-one personal ministry to one another. And I guess that to me that's very important. Place a greater emphasis on the one-on-one ministry and a little less emphasis on the quarterly voters meetings, even though they're important, they're necessary. But are they as necessary, and do they have to have the high level priority that we're giving them? I perceive not. I perceive they need to have a greater emphasis on the leadership and one-on-one personal ministry, and blessings will really grow. Outreach, evangelism, and inactives. Only 5 out of nearly 50 congregations had an evangelism program. Sad. Only 2 pastors had a prospect file. And what does that say? You know, that's a whole area then. They're not really full service. And what does this say when there's no prospect file, when most of us know that, you know, insurance salesmen, if they have no prospect file, they're dead in the water. A congregation that has no prospect file just isn't going to grow numerically and possibly not spiritually. And we need to help that. And so often I perceive that they don't have an evangelism program. And when they don't, when a pastor struggles to get somebody involved in evangelism and he can't get anybody, he then also walks away and says, well, they don't want it. And that's kind of sad. Another one is pastor leadership. My time is running out, but I think I need to share this with you. Pastor leadership is very important. Rural congregations have a particular, their own perception of pastor leadership, and it's different. What I'm going to read to you is just about 3/4 of a page. It's a real honest evaluation by the people of that pastor, and also my evaluation as I observed him, talked to him, and in the think tank session with the congregation. And in the nearly 50 congregations I visit, this fits 5 of those 50 pastors, or nearly 50 pastors. And this one particular, and the others were about that same size. 168 baptized, 109 communicant members. It's in a village of 50 people. There are 4 Missouri Synod congregations within a 12-mile radius, 3 of which have large Christian day schools. This pastor is a general practitioner pastor with special gifts in ministry, excellent in people relationship skills. He's a good shepherd, a good caregiver, a good preacher, a good worship leader. He is very approachable, exercises common sense. This is what the people said. Exercises good common sense, has very good communication skills. He is able to admit to mistakes, has a good sense of humor. He recognizes his weaknesses and has a desire to strengthen them. He sits with a family at the hospital during surgery of a loved one, even if the hospital is 150 miles away. He makes frequent visits to the hospital regardless of the distance, often daily. He goes fishing with the members, goes out and works with the farmers. He puts on jeans and coveralls, assists the farmers when the opportunity arises. He dresses casual at all times, seldom wears a clergy collar, probably on Sunday, sometimes for funerals. He attends all the farm auctions within a 50-mile radius. After all, most of his members will be there. He is known by members and non-members of the community, but also the neighboring communities. They all know him, who he is, and they know him on a first-name basis. He is recognized as the pastor of this village, but he is also recognized as the pastor of the whole community. He calls on people annually, goes out to see them, both members and non-members, has a prospect file, and he does this in a very approachable manner. The people in those neighboring communities and outlying areas appreciate and enjoy seeing him in their communities. There's a unity in the congregation, much joy and appreciation for the ministry, and excitement for the congregation because it's growing spiritually. 15 miles from 4 Missouri Synod congregations. It's growing spiritually and numerically, and it's a good match. And this congregation had as its primary reason for being to preach the Word of God in its truth and purity, and it's our pastor does that. Can you imagine? That's different, isn't it? But that's what the rural people really appreciate and really expect. Facilities, church and parsonage, you know, they are important. And congregation needs a new parsonage. Those 13 years, I told many congregations, I said, your parsonage isn't too good. I said, how do you expect to call a pastor? And pretty soon, they built a new parsonage. They put in a lot of volunteer time, and they spend $50,000-$60,000 on it, and almost have it paid for the time it's built. And many of them are putting in handicapped facilities in their rural congregations, all indicating, hey, we're here to stay. We're here to stay to do ministry. Caring, they're very caring. Everybody cares for one another. They reach out to one another. Mission and ministry statement, there's only three congregations out of nearly 50 had a mission and ministry statement. And I guess I perceive that's very important. And that's one of my recommendations. Stewardship, many of us might think that there's a stewardship of giving to needs. Well, probably is. They need a parsonage, so they give to the parsonage. They need to put it on a new roof, $15,000, and give to the new roof. But I guess as I listen to these, they also have grown in the grace of giving considerably. More and more and more rural congregations have no cash flow problem. Because the money is there in rural America. And they give generously. And many of our congregations in rural areas get better for district and senate than the city congregations. Many of our pastors get upset because, you know, they always raise district and senate, but they haven't gotten a salary increase in 5 years. They come to me and say, hey, Elder, aren't you going to do something about it? And I said, what can I do? I said, they have a commitment to missions. Yeah, they do, but they haven't raised my salary. Have you looked at your own ministry? I then talk to them and say, hey, don't forget the pastor. Increase his salary. And that's the rural area. Strategic planning and setting goals is a vital dimension, which rural parishes don't do, but we need to help them to do. User-friendly, that's a difficult aspect. Barna has a lot to say about it. We probably don't agree with everything Barna says, rural congregations are user-friendly. What they don't perceive, but if you address it and talk to them about it, they are willing to admit. It's pretty easy to be user-friendly with the people that you see all the time, that you see on the street at the co-op store, in the filling station, in the grocery store, and they say, yeah? Somebody raises his hand and says, you know, I've been a member here 20 years, and I'm married into this congregation, and I still feel like an outsider. And they all kind of turn around and look at that person. But, you know, it's difficult for an outsider to become an insider in rural America. Structure. I think that many are over-structured because rural ministry is more a presence than program. And I think that's an important dimension to understand. Congregations, rural communities need to be willing to change their style and form of ministry in a changing rural scene to meet the needs of ministry of their members and the people of the ministry service area. In my reports to the congregation and to AAL and the Senate, instead of church, I use ministry service center. The word church, you know, pastors in confirmation class really make sure that the members understand church is people, church is people. And so I use ministry service center. Then I help them understand and evaluate what is your ministry service area. Congregations need to determine what is our ministry service area. One congregation in 1964, the district leadership told them, you know, they was going to build a new church. Little community, about 50 people, still has 50. Only service there is a co-op store and an international Case International dealer. It's all there. Oh, two bars. So the district leader said, hey, don't build. You're going to die. Now, this is 62. You're going to die. The congregation was shocked that the district leader said they're going to die. And so they shelved their plans. 3 years later, they said, hey, we got to build. So they pulled out the plans, didn't discuss it with district leadership, built a church in 65, paid for it in 7 years. They're part of a dual parish. The pastor lives at the other parish, the other congregation. And when I was there and did a visitation, I said, what are your goals? Our goals? We're going to be a single parish. What's another goal? We're going to call our own pastor. We're going to separate the leadership, the dual parish. Oh, we'll serve them, but it'll be from here. What's your ministry service area? Well, let's see. We're all around these couple little towns, and to the south is 55 miles. And we're going to do a better job than we've ever done to minister to that ministry service area, 55 miles one way south. That's exciting. There's a lot of exciting things going on there. I'll just kind of, maybe a couple of things. I mentioned pastoral leadership is important. You know, rural pastors, graduates or others, need to understand that rural is a culture, and rural congregations, agriculture, and a heritage of community and congregation is rural. Pastors of rural parishes must appreciate and understand and grow in their knowledge of rural people. They need to make a commitment to stay. Oh, about 10 years ago, I was visiting with the graduates placed in Nebraska, and several said, we're going to stay 5 years. Elder, we're going to stay 5 years. On the way home, I got upset. Just really got upset. Going to stay 5 years. Well, because a seminary prof told us to do that. So the next time, placement, I said, and I heard it again. I said, so I just said, hey, I don't like that. You know, you're placed in a rural parish till further notice. And I think that you need to work at it till further notice. And that's important there, really. Dress is important. Successful rural pastors are not aloof. And they look at it this way. Christ came into our midst and became one of us, but without sin. Pastors come to our midst to become one of us with the office of the public ministry. Many times I would go out in rural Nebraska, particularly remote areas, and a pastor, the elder, get rid of that tie. And they would take the tie off of me. Because you don't relate to people here with a tie. Some of our rural pastors are successful will say, hey, I've got one tie, I don't know where it is. That just happened last week. I asked a pastor at a conference, I said, I called him by name, I said, you got a tie? Because I've never seen him with a tie. Well, he said, yeah, no, I don't, yeah, I have to have one in the back of the closet, he says. And I guess I'm to the point where I say and perceive that clergy collars are inappropriate dress in many of our rural communities, except on Sunday. That is what I perceive in the last 15 years, particularly this last year. I said this at a conference, and one young pastor kind of gets upset. And he says, I got to wear it, I got to wear it. He says, I earned it, you know, and I got to wear it. People then know who I am. And then he said, they got to know who I am. And I said, when I was in a parish, I said, I had a quote on the wall that said, if you're a Christian, when you enter a group or of people, you do not have to announce that you are a Christian to them, because your words, your action, and your life will communicate that you are. If you are a pastor and enter a group, you do not need to wear a clergy collar to indicate who you are. Your life, your conversation, and your ministry will determine that you're a pastor. And of course then, that took him off the defensive, and afterwards we had a good talk. Special challenges. The key word in the 90s is satisfaction. Sam Walton, did that. Many people accuse Sam Walton of destroying Main Street America. Just heard it again this past week. But when Sam Walton was told that, he said, if I had not come into the community to serve it better, someone else would have. I think that's true for our rural churches. We need to serve them better. If we don't, some other Christian denomination or some non-Christian group will come in and serve them better and get all of the prospects. The key word is satisfaction, and it really rubs over. Our people, Sam Walton's exchange policy, no questions asked, it rubs over the church, Those people that expect satisfaction in a secular community expect their needs to be satisfied in the congregation. Denominational loyalty is no longer important as it was. It's important for me and most of you and all of you, but it isn't to those that have never been a Christian. And many of the people in rural communities never been Christian. They, when they have problems, want their needs ministered to, they would care less about the denomination because they have no knowledge of denominations. The congregation needs to be really known as a ministry service center. And quality is a high-level word today. And people that expect quality in a secular community very naturally will expect quality when they come to church. And I think that many of our rural congregations fail to perceive that. Service is another quality out there. They expect service in the community. They expect service in the church. The rural congregation, by tradition, is a caring congregation which it has received through its heritage and rural peerage. It is small enough to care. That's a tremendous quality. And this needs to be recognized and emphasized as positive. In conclusion, Our nation was born a rural nation and thrived for several centuries as an agricultural nation. The values of rural culture were the values of our nation. Our church, the LCMS, was born in a rural culture, thrived for a century with its roots deep in rural America, the rural culture. The heritage and values of rural America was shaped by the Christian values of our Synod and of our people in rural America. Our Synod is what it is today because of its roots in rural America, and the values shaped also our Synod. Let us not vacate rural America. Let us revitalize the small, declining parish. Let us assist them in regaining their church esteem. As other denominations pull out, and they're pulling out, of rural America, we will remain with a positive and full-service ministry to our members, to the unchurched, and to the entire ministry service area. As small villages decline, let us become the pillar of strength for rural community, reclaiming community esteem, maintaining the values of the rural culture, and preserving the rural culture for its values and the deep agricultural roots. There will always be people in rural America who need ministry. We need to be there as the church, the ministry service center, God's people ministering to the people that are there. The rural and open country parish is valid, it's important, with tremendous opportunities, both today, in this decade, and the next century. Rural America is about 45% unchurched. Importance is not measured by bigness, by size, or numbers. Importance and validity of ministry is measured by ministry of God's people to the unchurched and a ministry service area. Live and minister in anticipation of God's presence, His blessings on the membership and ministry service area. And then we can conclude with the great Apostle Paul. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than we desire would dare to ask, by the power at work within us, to him be honor and glory in the church and in Christ Jesus, now and forever. Amen.
Thank you very much. We've got time for two or three questions. I do want to tell you that Dr. Meyer is going to go to the dining hall after he's done here, and we'll be in the dining hall if you would like to talk to him there on this topic, and then he'll be in the library conference room this afternoon from 1 to 3, and anyone that desires can go by and talk to him at that time about rural ministry. So we've got time for two or three questions.
Pastor, I have a question. How easy is it for someone coming from a metropolitan area to become involved in rural ministry? Will they accept you? And I'm coming from a metropolitan area, and I've always been interested in it, but I've heard some real horror stories, and I don't know if that was because of the pastor or the people, or a combination.
Did you hear his question? How can a pastor from metro areas, oriented metro, survive in a rural parish? The rural people are very perceptive. One of the qualities I failed to mention here is the love aspect. If a pastor from a metro area loves his people and is interested in them, they will share with him. And they will invite him out. I know a pastor came from New York. Fantastic. And he drove up to this rural parish, he and his wife, and they cried. They said, and so when they talked to me, they said, we're not going to stay any longer than we have to. We're going to get back east. But he was smart enough to love them, and within a year, they were inviting him out, and he got interested in Old Herefords with one family, rode a combine with another one, and he was very inquiring in a genuine, not artificial way, a genuine way. And he's still there. He's been there now 15 years. Well, he's moved once, but to a little larger parish in Nebraska. The East no longer interests him because he made the transition. It can be done. Love the people and be interested in a genuine way.
You mentioned the low emphasis on evangelism and outreach. I wonder how much of that is because of a perceived, we don't want to steal the Catholics away or the Methodists or whatever because it's a small town, there's kind of no who goes to this church and so on. And I wonder if that's a possible reason.
I think the bigger reason than that is that they know everybody, and it's difficult to you know, work with somebody you know that lives a pretty clean life and this type of thing. So how do you approach a neighbor, a friend, to go to church when you know they don't? Normally, in the think tank session with the congregation, they say, well, everybody's church. And somebody said, well, maybe I ask them, what percent is unchurched? Is it 5%, 10%? And so I really just kind of hung on. Pretty soon, within 10 minutes, they say, you know, you're right. As I look at the people in this little village, I bet you 50% don't go to church. And so, you know, it's a perception, you're right. They perceive that everybody goes. And the difficulty in calling on people you know, that you've known all their life. You know their problems, you know their joys, etc. Question? Yes.
Along with that idea, I think that there's a stumbling block of the people themselves in the congregation due to the fact that they don't want a whole lot of people integrating, quote unquote, their church. That's the mentality I've seen several times, and because we are a staunch German background and our heritage is there, and now we have to be more open to the mobility of other people coming in. How would you work with that congregation to understand the openness there, that this is not, quote, their church as far as this God's church?
I think what you're saying, you know, was very true, you know, a decade ago and probably up until recently. Right now, that is changing considerably because the declining population, there is a strong struggle to survive. But I think the theme that we're using a lot at rural ministry conferences is thriving beyond surviving. And so more and more people are saying, hey, we have to. And so the climate has changed, and I think, again, it's just love them and not be afraid to take the leadership and do it by yourself. You know, in evangelism particularly, just do it by yourself for a while and then try to get somebody to work with you. It's a slow process, but it can happen. Any other questions? Well, yes, I'm making individual congregational reports, and I'll take to the congregation with recommendations for improvement, and I'll follow up on those 50 congregations. And then I'll make a composite report for the church. AAL, of course, will get their copies, and in each district, and the CMCC at the International Center. And maybe one more thing I failed to mention, and I thought of it when I was closing, but I guess I'm to the point that, you know, in the past, and it was obvious to me when I was a DP, that we always look to the rural areas to for places for our graduates to start, because I heard placement directors of the seminary say, and they shared with me, you know, they said, well, graduates say, you know, the placement directors say to the graduating class, don't worry, we'll have a place for you because Nebraska and the Dakotas and Kansas and Iowa will hand in enough calls so there's a place for everybody to serve. I guess I'm at the point where I perceive that the time is past for us to place graduates in rural areas just so they have a place to start ministry. Because they get hurt. If they really do not have the gifts and ability to learn the culture and be a part of that community, the graduate and his family are going to be hurting. And the congregation is going to be hurting. And so we probably should change that process a little bit. Like, we don't place graduates in foreign soil just to give them a place to start. You know, they go through the interviews, they go through psychological testing, and then they go to mission school for 6 months or a year. Then they go to foreign soil. And I think that rural ministry is a culture just unique. If we don't place graduates in foreign soil and in black ministry just so they have a place to start, we shouldn't do that in rural ministry. And we ought to take some guidance from what they do for foreign fields, that maybe we need to do a better job of informing our graduates before they hit the field and have a rural ministry school for a month or 2 weeks even. To help our graduates make that adjustment so they know what to expect. Now that's kind of a strong statement, but that's my perception.
Let's just say I'm curious to see how many of the students here are from rural areas and they raise their hands.
Fair enough.
I would also say that a lot of times I think some of you guys are missing the perceptions that coming from a rural congregation and having pastors who were not real enthusiastic about it, these churches do want to grow. and they do want to evangelize, and what happens is the pastor is not enthusiastic about it, and the people get together in this world, they share everything, and they're saying, this pastor really doesn't get it. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't care. They do want to go.
Thank you once again, and for being with us.